This is Audible.
Listening Library presents Monster by Walter Dean Myers.
The best time to cry is at night, when the lights are out and someone is being beaten up and screaming for help. That way, even if you sniffle a little, they won't hear you. If anybody knows that you're crying, they'll start talking about it, and soon it'll be your turn to get beat up when the lights go out. There's a mirror over the steel sink in my cell. It's 6 inches high and scratched with the names of some guys who were here before me. When I look into the small rectangle, I see a face looking back at me, but I don't recognize it. It doesn't look like me. I couldn't have changed that much in a few months. I wonder if I would look like myself when the trial is over. This morning at breakfast, a guy got hit in the face with a tray. Somebody said some little thing and somebody else got mad. There was blood all over the place. When the guards came over, they made us line up against the wall. The guy who was hit, they made sit at the table while they waited for another guard to bring them rubber gloves. When the gloves came, the guards put them on, handcuffed the guy, and then took him to the dispensary. He was still bleeding pretty bad. They say you get used to being in jail, but I don't see how. Every morning I wake up and I'm surprised to be here. If your life outside was real, then everything in here is just the opposite. We sleep with strangers, wake up with strangers, and go to the bathroom in front of strangers. They're strangers, but they still find reasons to hurt each other. Sometimes I feel like I have walked into the middle of a movie. It is a strange movie with no plot and no beginning. The movie is in black and white and grainy. Sometimes the camera moves in so close that you can't tell what's going on and you just listen to the sounds and guess. I've seen movies of prisons, but never one like this. This is not a movie about bars and locked doors. It is about being alone when you are not really alone, and it is about being scared all the time. I think to get used to this, I will have to give up what I think is real and take up something else. I wish I could make sense of it. Maybe I could make my own movie. I could write it out and play it in my head. I could block out the scenes like we did in school. The film would be the story of my life. No, not my life, but of this experience. I'll write it down in the notebook they let me keep. I'll call it what the lady who is the prosecutor called me. Monster.
Monday, July 6th. Monster. Fade in, interior. Early morning in cell block D, Manhattan Detention Center. Camera goes slowly down grim gray corridor. There are sounds of inmates yelling from cell to cell. Much of it is obscene. Most of the voices are clearly black or Hispanic. Camera stops and slowly turns toward a cell. 16-year-old Steve Harmon is sitting on the edge of a metal cot, head in hands. He is thin, brown-skinned. On the cot next to him are the suit and tie he is to wear to court for the start of his trial. Cut to Ernie, another prisoner, sitting on John, pants down. Then Sunset, another prisoner, pulling on T-shirt. Then Steve, pulling blanket over his head as screen goes dark.
Ain't no use putting the blanket over your head, man. You can't cut this out. This is reality. This is the real deal.
The anonymous prisoner continues explaining how the detention center is the real thing. As he does, words appear on the screen, just like the opening credits of the movie Star Wars, rolling from the bottom of the screen and shrinking until they are a blur on the top of the screen before rolling off into space. Monster, the story of my miserable life, starring Steve Harmon. Produced by Steve Harmon. Directed by Steve Harmon. Credits continue to roll. The incredible story of how one guy's life was turned around by a few events and how he might spend the rest of his life behind bars, told as it actually happened. Written and directed by Steve Harmon, featuring Sandra Petricelli as the dedicated prosecutor, Kathy O'Brien as the defense attorney with doubts, James King as the thug, Richard Bobo Evans as the rat, Osvaldo Cruz, member of the Diablos, as the tough guy wannabe, Laurel Henry as the witness, Jose Delgado, he found the body, and starring 16-year-old Steve Harmon as the boy on trial for murder. Filmed at the Manhattan Detention Center, set design, handcuffs, and prison outfits by the state of New York.
Yo, Harmon, you gonna eat something?
Come on, get your breakfast, man. I'll take your eggs if you don't want them. You want them?
I'm not hungry.
His trial starts today. He up for the big one. I know how that feels.
Cut to interior, corrections department van. Through the bars at the rear of the van, we see people going about the business of their lives in downtown New York. There are men collecting garbage, a female traffic officer motioning for a taxi to make a turn, students on the way to school. Few people notice the van as it makes its way from the detention center to the courthouse. Cut to prisoners, handcuffed, coming from back of van. Steve is carrying notebook. He is dressed in the suit and tie we saw on the cot. He is seen only briefly as he is herded through the heavy doors of the courthouse. Fade out as last prisoner from the van enters rear of courthouse. Fade in, interior, courthouse. We are in a small room used for prisoner-lawyer interviews. A guard sits at a desk behind Steve. Kathy O'Brien, Steve's lawyer, is petite, red-haired, and freckled. She is all business as she talks to Steve.
Let me make sure you understand what's going on. Both you and this King character are on trial for felony murder. Felony murder is as serious as it gets. Sandra Petricelli is the prosecutor, and she's good. They're pushing for the death penalty, which is really bad. The jury might think that they're doing you a big favor by giving you life in prison, so you better take this trial very, very seriously. When you're in court, you sit there and you pay attention. You let the jury know that you think the case is as serious as they do. You don't turn and wave to any of your friends. It's all right to acknowledge your mother. I have to go and talk to the judge. The trial will begin in a few minutes. Is there anything you want to ask me before it starts?
You think we're gonna win?
It probably depends on what you mean by win.
Cut to interior, holding room. We see Steve sitting at one end of bench. Against the opposite wall, dressed in a sloppy-looking suit, is 23-year-old James King, the other man on trial. King looks older than 23. He looks over at Steve with a hard look, and we see Steve look away. Two guards sit at a table away from the prisoners, who are handcuffed. The camera finds the guards in a medium shot. They have their breakfast in aluminum takeout trays that contain eggs, sausages, and potatoes. A black female stenographer pours coffee for herself and the guards.
I hope this case lasts 2 weeks. I can sure use the money.
6 days, maybe seven. It's a motion case. They go through the motions, then they lock them up. Ain't that right, Bright Eyes?
Cut to Steve, who is seated on a low bench. He is handcuffed to a U-bolt put in the bench for that purpose. Steve looks away from the guard. Cut to door. It opens, and court clerk looks in.
2 minutes.
Cut to guards who hurriedly finish breakfast. Stenographer takes machine into courtroom. They unshackle Steve and take him to a door. Steve is made to sit down at one table. At another table, we see King and two attorneys. Steve sits alone. A guard stands behind him. There are one or two spectators in the court. Then four more enter. The fear is evident on Steve's face. People are getting ready for the trial to begin. Kathy O'Brien sits next to Steve.
How are you doing?
I'm scared.
Good. You should be. Anyway, just remember what we've been talking about. The judge is going to rule on a motion that King's lawyer made to suppress Cruz's testimony and a few other things. Steve, let me tell you what my job is here. My job is to make sure the law works for you as well as against you, and to make you a human being in the eyes of the jury. Your job is to help me. Any questions you have, write them down and I'll try to answer them. What are you doing there?
I'm writing this whole thing down as a movie.
Whatever. Make sure you pay attention. Close attention.
All rise.
The judge enters and sits behind bench. He is tall and thin. He pushes his fingers through wisps of white hair and looks over the courtroom before sitting. He is a 60-year-old New York judge and already looks bored with the case. The court guard signals for people to sit.
Prosecution ready?
Sandra Petricelli, the prosecutor, stands. She is dressed in a gray business suit. She looks intense while still being attractive. Her hair and eyes are dark.
Ready, Your Honor.
Defense?
Asa Briggs, the lead counsel for the defense of James King, stands. He is dressed in a dark blue suit and a light blue tie. His eyes are also blue and his hair is white.
Ready?
Ready, Your Honor.
All right. I'm ruling the kid's testimony is admissible. You can bring up your motions relative to that ruling this afternoon or if there's a break. Hope everyone had a good 4th of July.
The usual barbecue and a softball game that reminded me that I can't run anymore.
With all the fireworks, it's my least favorite holiday.
Bring in the jury.
Cut to Film Workshop at Stuyvesant High School. A film on a small screen is just ending. It is a class project, and the camera is shaky. We watch as a girl on the screen walks slowly away. Screen goes black, then dazzling white, then normal as lights go on. We see Mr. Sawicki, film club mentor, and 9 students who are casually dressed.
In a juried competition, the ending would have hurt this piece, but otherwise it was interesting. Any comments?
We see Steve raising his hand, looking much the same as he does in court.
I liked the ending.
I didn't say it was bad, but wasn't it predictable? You need to predict without predicting, you know what I mean? When you make a film, you leave an impression on the viewers who serve as a kind of jury for your film. If you make your film predictable, they'll make up their minds about it long before it's over.
Cut to courtroom. We see the jurors filing in and taking their seats.
You think they look all right?
They are what we have for a jury. We have to deal with them.
Cut to Petrocelli. She stands at the podium in front of the jury. She smiles at the jurors, and some smile back.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Sandra Petrocelli, and I'm an assistant district attorney for the state of New York. I'm representing the people in this matter, which you were informed during jury selection is a case of felony murder. We're here today basically because this is not a perfect world. The founding fathers of our country understood this. They knew that there would be times and circumstances during which our society would be threatened by the acts of individuals. This is one of those times. A citizen of our city, a citizen of our state and country has been killed by people who attempted to rob him. To safeguard our society, a system of laws has been created. You, the jury, are part of this system of laws. I represent the state of New York, and I am part of that system, as are the judge and all the participants in this trial. I will do my best to bring you the facts of this case, and I know you will do your best to judge the merits of the case. Most people in our community are decent, hard-working citizens who pursue their own interests legally and without infringing on the rights of others. But there are also monsters in our communities. People who are willing to steal and kill. People who disregard the rights of others. On the 22nd of December of last year, at approximately 4 o'clock in the afternoon, 2 men entered a drugstore on 145th Street in Harlem. The state will contend that one of those men was Richard Bobo Evans. The state will contend that the other man who entered the store at that time and who participated in the robbery and the murder was James King.
Petrocelli points to the table at which James King sits.
Mr. King is the man sitting at that table who is wearing a brown suit and is sitting at the right of the table. You were introduced to him during the jury selection process. He is one of the men on trial here today. The purpose of the 2 men entering the store on that Monday was very simple. They were going to rob the owner, 55-year-old Alguinaldo Nesbitt. We will show that although the 2 men did not have a gun with them, the owner of the store did have a gun for which he had a license and produced it to defend his property. Mr. Evans, who participated in the robbery, will testify that there was a struggle, which resulted in the gun being discharged and Mr. Nesbitt being killed. Mr. Nesbitt had every right to defend his property, every right not to be robbed. We all have that right. Further, there will be evidence that prior to the robbery, there was a plan or conspiracy to rob the store. Mr. Evans and Mr. King were to enter the store and do the actual robbery. Another of the planners of this crime was to stand outside the drugstore and impede anyone chasing the robbers. The young man who had this assignment will testify to his role in the affair. Yet another of the conspirators, the planners of this robbery that left a man dead, was to go into the store prior to the robbery to check it out, to make sure that there were no police in the store, to make sure that the coast was clear, as they say. 2 of the conspirators will testify to their understanding of this fact. The man who was to enter the store and check it out is sitting at the other table. His name is Stephen Harmon.
Cut to Steve Harmon, then close-up of the pad in front of him. He is writing the word monster over and over again. O'Brien's hand takes the pencil from his hand and crosses out all the monsters.
You have to believe in yourself if we're going to convince a jury that you're innocent.
Cut to Petrocelli.
A medical examiner will testify to the cause of death, showing that the gunshot wound was fatal. Even though it was Mr. Nesbitt's gun, it was not Mr. Nesbitt who caused his own death. This was no suicide. This death was a direct result of the robbery. Very simply put, this is a case of murder. It is, moreover, a murder committed during a felonious act. The two defendants you see before you will be shown to be participants in that act and are being charged with felony murder. Later, the judge will give you instructions on how to consider the evidence presented. But there is no doubt in my mind, and I believe by the end of the trial there will be little doubt in yours, that these two men, James King and Stephen Harmon, were all part of the robbery that caused the death of Aguinaldo Nesbitt. Thank you.
Cut to courtroom. O'Brien is at attorney's podium. Cut to Steve's mother on wooden bench in the gallery area, listening intently. Her face looks worried.
The state correctly says that the laws of a society provide protection for its citizens. When a crime is committed, it is the state that must apply the law in a manner that offers redress and that brings the guilty parties to justice. But the laws also protect the accused, and that is the wonder and beauty of the American system of justice. We don't drag people out of their beds in the middle of the night and lynch them. We don't torture people. We don't beat them. We apply the law equally to both sides. The law that protects society protects all of society. In this case, we will show that the evidence that the state will produce is seriously flawed. We will show not only that there is room for reasonable doubt, and you will hear more about that idea at the end of this trial, but that the doubt that Steve Harmon has committed any crime at all, is overwhelming. As Mr. Harmon's attorney, all I ask of you, the jury, is that you look at Steve Harmon now and remember that at this moment, the American system of justice demands that you consider him innocent. He is innocent until proven guilty. If you consider him innocent now, and by law you must, if you have not prejudged him, then I don't believe we will have a problem convincing you that nothing the state will produce will challenge that innocence. Thank you.
Cut to Briggs.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Asa Briggs, and I will be defending Mr. King. Miss Petrocelli, representing the state, has presented this case in very broad and grandiose terms, but you will soon see that her key witnesses are among the most self-serving, heartless people imaginable. Some of them will begin their testimony by swearing that they are criminals. You will have the unpleasant task of listening to people who have committed crimes, who have lied and stolen, and in at least one instance has been an admitted, and let me emphasize this, an admitted accomplice to murder. But in the end, you will have the opportunity to judge the state's key witnesses and to deliver a just verdict. What I am asking you to do is just that. Judge what they bring up on the witness stand, and then deliver your just verdict. Thank you.
Cut to witness stand. Jose Delgado is on the stand. He is young, very well built, and articulate.
I'm on until 9. The store closes at 9. So in the afternoon, I either go home and grab a bite or go out for Chinese. That night I went out for Chinese. Usually I get something and eat it in the back. When I went out, everything was okay.
What time did you leave the drugstore?
4:30, maybe 4:35 at the latest.
And what did you discover on your return?
At first I didn't see anything, which I knew was weird because Mr. Nesbitt wouldn't leave the place empty. I went around behind the counter and I saw Mr. Nesbitt on the floor. There was blood everywhere, and the cash register was open. A lot of cigarettes were missing too, maybe 5 cartons.
And did you call the police?
Yeah, but I knew Mr. Nesbitt was dead.
Mr. Delgado, are you familiar with the so-called martial arts?
Oh, that's my hobby. I have a black belt in karate.
Is that fact pretty well known in the neighborhood in which the drugstore operated?
Yeah, because whenever I was in a match and it made the papers, Mr. Nesbitt used to put the paper in the window.
Did police ever visit the drugstore?
Sometimes they would come in and sneak a smoke.
Nothing further.
You state that 5 cartons of cigarettes were missing.
That's right.
5, not 6.
Afterward, I checked the inventory. It was 5.
What medical school did you attend?
None.
But you said you knew that Mr. Nesbitt was dead. You were sure of it. That right?
Pretty sure.
Sure enough to stop and do inventory before trying to help your boss?
I didn't take inventory right away. I just noticed. You work in a store, you notice if something is missing.
How long did it take?
I don't remember.
Nothing further.
No questions.
Jose begins to step down.
The state calls Salvatore Zinzi.
Cut to Sal Zinzi on the stand. He is nervous, slightly overweight. He wears thick glasses, which he touches over and over again as he testifies.
Mr. Zinzi, where were you when you first became involved with this case?
Rikers Island.
And why were you there?
Stolen property. Guy sold me some baseball cards. They were stolen.
You knew they were stolen?
Yeah, I guess.
While you were at Rikers Island, did you engage in a certain conversation with a Wendell Bolden?
Yes, ma'am.
You want to tell me about the conversation?
He said he knew about a drugstore holdup where a guy was killed, and he was thinking of turning the guy in to get a break.
And what did you do as a result of this conversation?
I called Detective Gluck and told him what I knew.
Because you wanted a break too, is that right?
Yeah.
So Bolden told you he knew about the crime. Was there anything else?
That was it.
Did he tell you about some cigarettes?
Yeah, he...
Objection! She's leading.
Withdrawn. What else did he tell you?
That he got some cigarettes from this guy. 2 cartons.
Did he tell you the name of the person he got the cigarettes from?
No, just that he was sure the guy was involved in the holdup.
Nothing further.
Cut to Briggs at the podium.
You wanted a break, Mr. Zinzi. Why did you need a break? You only had a few months to do, isn't that right?
Some guys were sexually harassing me, sir.
Sexually harassing? Were they calling you a sissy? What does sexually harass mean to you?
They wanted to have sex with me.
So to save yourself from being gang raped, is that what they wanted to do to you?
Yeah.
And you were afraid?
Yeah.
You were afraid, and you would have said just about anything to get out of that situation, isn't that right?
I guess so.
Would you lie?
No.
Let me get this straight, Mr. Zinzi. You'd buy stolen goods for profit, rat on somebody to save your own hide, but you're too good to lie. Is that right?
I'm not lying now.
As a matter of fact, this Bolden was going to see what he could get out of this, but you stole his chance too, didn't you?
I guess.
No further questions.
Mr. Zinzi, how long were you in jail?
43 days.
Do people in jail look for stories to report to the police?
Objection. The question's too vague.
Well, let me put it this way, Mr. Zinzi. This Mr. Bolden was going to use this story for his own benefit, is that right?
Right.
And you decided to use it for your benefit.
Right. Lots of guys in jails do that.
You use stories and you use people, right?
Sometimes.
And the outcome of your talking with the detective in question is that you were able to reach the district attorney's office and strike a deal. Isn't that right? You were able to strike a deal that got you out of jail early. Isn't that right?
That's right.
You happy with the deal?
Yeah.
Nothing further.
Mr. Zinzi, do you know when you're lying and when you're telling the truth?
Yes. Sure.
You telling the truth now?
Yeah.
Nothing further.
Flashback of 12-year-old Steve walking in a neighborhood park with his friend, Tony.
They should let me pitch. I can throw straight as anything.
Tony scoops up a rock.
See the lamppost?
He throws the rock. We see that it bounces in front of the post and careens slightly to one side.
You can't throw.
Steve picks up rock and throws it. We see it sail past the post and hit a young woman. The tough guy she is walking with turns and sees the 2 young boys. He approaches.
Hey, man, who threw that rock?
Tony, run!
Tony takes a tentative step.
What?
Tough guy punches Tony. Tony falls. Tough guy stands over Tony as Steve backs off. Young woman pulls tough guy away and they leave. Tony and Steve are left in the park, with Tony sitting on the ground.
I didn't throw that rock. You threw it.
I didn't say you threw it. I just said run. You should have run.
I'll get me an Uzi and blow his brains out.
Tuesday, July 7th. Notes. I can hardly think about the movie. I hate this place so much. But if I didn't think of the movie, I would go crazy. All they talk about in here is hurting people. If you look at somebody, they say, "What you looking at me for? I'll mess you up." If you make a noise they don't like, they say they'll mess you up. One guy has a knife. It's not really a knife, but a blade glued onto a toothbrush handle. I hate this place. I hate this place. I can't write it enough times to make it look the way I feel. I hate, hate, hate this place.
Cut to interior courtroom. Wendell Bolden is on the stand. He is average height but heavily built, with large, ashy hands. He acts like he's mad and wants everybody to know it.
Mr. Bolden, have you ever been arrested?
Yeah, for B&E in possession with intent.
Possession is obviously drugs and the intent to distribute. Can you tell the jury what B&E means?
B&E, breaking and entering.
And what were you in for when you spoke to Mr. Zinzi?
Assault.
But the charges were dropped?
Yeah, they were dropped.
Can you tell us about the conversation between you and Mr. Zinzi?
I got some cigarettes from a guy who told me he was in on a drugstore robbery up on Malcolm X Boulevard. I knew a dude got killed, and I was thinking of trading what I knew for some slack.
As a matter of fact, didn't Mr. Zinzi also try to use that information himself?
He called a detective he knew.
Can you name the person involved in the robbery?
Objection. He can testify to the conversation, not the robbery, unless he was there.
Withdrawn. So who gave you the information that he was involved in a robbery?
Bobo Evans.
Camera pans to King, who gives Bolden a dirty look. Cut to, exterior, stoop on 141st Street. There is a small tricycle on the sidewalk. It is missing one wheel. The garbage cans at the curb are overflowing. Three young girls jump rope near the trash. James, King, and Steve are sitting on the steps. A heavy woman, Peaches, sits slightly above them, and a thin man, Johnny, stands. He is smoking a blunt.
I need to get paid, man. I ain't got nothing between my butt and the ground but a rag.
I hear that.
You can't even hardly make it these days. They're talking about cutting welfare, cutting Social Security, and anything else that makes life a little easy. Psst, they might as well bring back slavery times if you ask me.
If I had a crew, I could get paid. All you need is a crew with some heart and a nose for the cash.
Banks is where the money is.
No, bank money is too serious. The man comes down hard for bank money. You need to find a get-over where nobody don't care. You know what I mean. You cop from somebody with a green card on illegal, and they don't even report it.
Restaurant owners got money, too. That's the only things left in our neighborhood. Restaurants, liquor stores, and drug stores.
What you got, young blood?
I don't know.
Yo, what's your name? Steve. Since when you been down?
Cut to interior courtroom. Bolden is still on the stand.
So he turned me on to two cottons for $5 each. I asked him how he copped, and he said he was in a robbery in a drugstore. I didn't say no more because all I wanted was the smokes.
Did he tell you when the store was robbed?
He said it just went down.
And when did this conversation take place?
The day before Christmas. I remember that because I gave a carton of cigarettes to my mom's as a present.
No further questions.
How well do you know Mr. Evans?
I know him when I see him.
Did you know him before Christmas?
Not really.
Let's see now. You don't know this man. And yet, when you ask him where he got the cigarettes, he's going to tell you that he got them from a holdup in which he was involved and in which a man was killed.
If he wants to run his mouth, that's his business.
And didn't you think it strange that a man would give out information that could be harmful to him if he had actually been involved in this case?
Cut to juror, looking bored. Cut to Bolden.
Hey, I don't even care.
Your assault charge was dropped, is that correct?
Yeah.
The maximum sentence for the assault was how long, do you know?
I wasn't convicted.
Do you know the maximum sentence?
Objection.
Overruled. It's pertinent.
So you saved yourself some heavy jail time by pointing a finger at Mr. King, isn't that right?
I just wanted to do the right thing. You know, like a good citizen.
You were in jail trying to be a good citizen? Or were you really just trying to get out of jail and not caring who you put in? Isn't that what you're really doing? Well, isn't it?
Objection. Defense counsel is stepping over his bounds.
This is a good time for a break. I have some administrative tasks to get done this afternoon. Let's adjourn until tomorrow. I want to remind the jury not to discuss the case with anyone. We'll reconvene at 9 a.m. tomorrow.
Cut to interior, detention center. It is night. The lights are out except for dim nightlights placed along the walls. We hear the sounds of fists, methodically punching someone as the camera goes slowly down the corridor, almost seeming to look for the source of the hitting. We see two inmates silhouetted, beating a third. Another inmate is on lookout. Cut to Steve lying on his cot. The sounds are in his cell, but he is not the one being beaten. We see the whites of his eyes, then we see him close his eyes as the sounds of the beating stop, and the sounds become those of a sexual attack against the inmate who was beaten. Fade out. Fade in, interior, Steve's home. It is neatly furnished, clean. Steve is watching TV with 11-year-old Jerry, his brother.
You ever want to be a superhero? You know, save people and stuff?
Sure. You know who I want to be? Superman. I'd be wearing glasses and stuff, and people would be messing with me, and then I'd kick butt.
I bet you'd be a cool superhero. You know who you should be?
Who?
Batman. Then I could be Robin.
Steve gives Jerry a brotherly shove. Fade out.
Wednesday, July 8th. They take away your shoelaces and your belt so you can't kill yourself no matter how bad it is. I guess making you live is part of the punishment. It's funny, but when I'm sitting in the courtroom, I don't feel like I'm involved in the case. It's like the lawyers and the judge and everybody are doing a job that involves me, but I don't have a role. It's only when I go back to the cells that I know I'm involved. Miss O'Brien says that Petrocelli is using Bolden's testimony as part of a trail that will lead to me and James King. I think she's wrong. I think they're bringing out all these people and letting them look terrible on the stand and sound terrible, and then reminding the jury that they don't look any different from me and King. I like the last scene in the movie, the one between me and Jerry. It makes me seem like a real person. The man they call Sunset asked me if he could read the screenplay, and I let him. He liked it. Sunset said he liked the name of the screenplay. He said when he gets out, he will have the word monster tattooed on his forehead. I feel like I already have it tattooed on mine. A preacher came to the recreation room with a guard this afternoon. He asked if anyone wanted to talk with him or share a moment of prayer. Two guys said they did, and I was just about ready to say I would when Lynch, a guy who was going on trial for killing his wife, started cursing at the preacher and saying that everybody wanted to talk to him and act like they were good when they were just criminals. It's too late to put up your holy front now, he said. In a way, he was right, at least about me. I want to look like a good person. I want to feel like I'm a good person because I believe I am. But being in here with these guys makes it hard to think about yourself as being different. We look about the same, and even though I'm younger than they are, it's hard not to notice that we are all pretty young. I see what Miss O'Brien meant when she said part of her job was to make me look human in the eyes of the jury. When Lynch started cursing at the preacher, the guards took the preacher out, and then they came back and turned the television off and made us go back to our cells. Notes. I couldn't sleep most of the night after the dream. The dream took place in the courtroom. I was trying to ask questions, and nobody could hear me. I was shouting and shouting, but everybody went about their business as if I wasn't there. I hope I didn't shout out in my sleep. That would look weak to everybody. It's not good to be weak in here. Every morning we get up and put on our court clothes. The talk is lawyer talk, with all the older guys talking about appeals and mistakes that the judge made. I feel terrible. My stomach is gassy and bloated. I still can't go to the bathroom in front of everyone. When we got in the court, there was a delay because the stenographer had brought the wrong power cord. The court officer was talking about termites.
Fade in, courtroom. Steve and King are cuffed to a bench. Court officers, Petrocelli, stenographer, judge, Briggs, and O'Brien are present.
So this guy comes to the house and tells Vivian we got termites. I get home and she's all upset. I said, no way we got termites, no way.
You ever see any termites?
What the heck's a termite look like?
Like an ant with wings.
Then I've never seen one.
I heard they hide in the wood.
What I don't understand is why they have wings if they stay in the wood.
Are you going to let us do the affidavit on the crime scene?
Any objections?
Who's going to read it in court?
The clerk.
No objections.
What's with the detective?
Well, he's having problems with a hemorrhoid operation.
Wait, I didn't know that. Maybe we can keep him on the stand for an hour or two.
Cut to close-up of Petrocelli.
Detective Carroll, can you describe the scene when you entered the drugstore?
It was pretty gruesome.
Cut to interior. Camera pans down aisles of neighborhood drugstore. Cut to Jose Delgado. He moves in slow motion. He is pale, glancing nervously at a point out of sight of camera. He is explaining something to Detective Carroll, who stands leaning against counter. The detective is heavy, stooped. Cut to a shot of open cash register. Cut to courtroom.
Are these the pictures you took at that time?
The crime scene photographer took them.
May I see them?
Petrocelli hands pictures to O'Brien, who places them before her on desk. Cut to close-up of photos. We see legs of the slain drugstore owner, Nesbitt. Cut to black and white shots from various angles of body in grotesque position. Pictures flash in an increasingly contrasty and grainy format until they are hardly recognizable.
Detective Carroll, when you discovered the body, were there any signs of life in the victim?
No, but I called the emergency medical service, which is standard procedure.
And you noted the open cash register?
That's correct. And at that time, I asked the clerk, was there anything else missing? Often in these cases, you might find some cough medicine missing or some attempt to open a restricted drugs case. There's a market for drugs of any kind.
Did you look for other clues, and did you find any?
We looked for other clues, but we didn't actually find anything.
Eventually, you began questioning suspects in this case. How did you come across the suspects?
We questioned a number of people we felt might have some knowledge of the crime. Then we received a tip from a person who claimed he knew what happened to the cigarettes.
That would be Mr. Zinzi.
That's correct. He told us about Mr. Bolden. Then Mr. Bolden told us about Mr. Evans and Mr. King.
And both Zinzi and Bolden had their own motives in doing this.
We often use information from informants, especially in murder cases.
And did you talk to Mr. King?
To Mr. King and to some of his associates.
Fade out. Fade in, interior, 28th Precinct. Steve is sitting on a long, dark bench. He is dressed in cutoffs, sneakers, and a t-shirt. There is a basketball on the floor near him. Detective Carroll is sitting across from Steve. He is eating a cheeseburger. Sometimes he talks with his mouth full. A black detective, Arthur Williams, sits on the edge of the table. He is dressed much as Steve is, and looks only a few years older.
This hand that you pulled the trigger. King said the score was over, but you turned your back and shot Nesbitt. Why'd you do that? I can't figure it.
I don't know what you're talking about, man. I didn't do any stick-up.
Oh, you figured you didn't want to leave any witnesses, I guess.
What are we playing with this guy for? We don't need him. We got the case locked.
The DA is thinking death penalty.
Death penalty? Chances are the judge will push for life without parole. And if they come clean, he might even go for 25 to life. You save a lot of time and money that way.
I don't know. The victim was well-respected in the neighborhood. Hard-working black guy, worked his way up. He even sponsored a little league team. The judge could go for the death penalty if they plead not guilty.
This guy's only 16. They won't kill him.
What are you, a pessimist? Hope for the best.
Cut to weird shot of interior. Death row. Steve is seen walking down the hallway between two guards. He is brought into the death chamber. The guards are pale, almost greenish. They lay Steve on the table for the lethal injection and strap him down. Close up of Steve's face. He is terrified.
Open your legs. We have to plug up your butt so you don't mess yourself as you die.
Steve's face grimaces with pain as they put in the plug. Cut to interior, courtroom. Carol is still on stand as Briggs cross-examines.
Did you dust the area for fingerprints?
It's my understanding that the crime scene technicians didn't find any fingerprints they could establish as belonging to a perpetrator.
Isn't it true that what you did in this case was to skip the investigation and run to your stoolies?
We treat each case carefully. We don't just go through the motions.
The cash register was handled, but you didn't find fingerprints, is that right?
Not clear prints.
How about the counter? Was that dusted for fingerprints?
Nothing clear enough to use.
And it really isn't that hard to find people who are in jail or whom you arrest to swear that somebody else is a bad guy, isn't that?